Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the July 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. A friend called from San Francisco Saturday to tell me that another friend, journalist Alexander Coburn, had died, and I'm still finding it difficult to absorb. He referred me to the Counterpunch website where Jeffrey St. Clair, Alex's co-editor of that remarkable daily newspaper of the Internet, had announced the news. Our friend and comrade Alexander Coburn died last night in Germany after a fierce two-year-long battle against cancer, wrote St. Clair. Alex kept his illness a tightly guarded secret. Only a handful of us knew how terribly sick he truly was. He didn't want the disease to define him. He didn't want his friends and readers to shower him with sympathy. Alex wanted to keep living his life right to the end. He wanted to live on his terms, and he wanted to continue writing through it all, just as his brilliant father, the novelist and journalist Claude Coburn, had done. And so he did. His body was deteriorating, but his prose remained as sharp, lucid, and deadly as ever. End quote. Those are the words of Jeffrey St. Clair writing about the death in Germany of his longtime friend and comrade and Counterpunch co-editor, Alexander Coburn, who was one of the finest political commentators in the English language and my old friend as well. I have had too many friends die from cancer in recent years, but none had such a vital public presence and none left such a vast space to fill. Alex had a way of dissecting the American political scene and U.S. foreign policy, of exposing his latent hypocrisy with a rapier wit that was unique and refreshing and never grew stale over the years. I began reading his columns on the Village Voice in the early 80s and continued when he moved to The Nation, and then the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which I discovered on a newsstand while living in San Francisco. In 1990, I convinced Alex to come down from Petrolia to speak at a Mother's Day evening event, the subject of which was to be, quote, Central America and the Middle East. Are they victims of the liberals' agenda? End quote. 1990. Although at first reluctant, after all, who would show up for a political speech on Mother's Day, Alexander couldn't turn down the opportunity to give the liberals a bashing. That night, thanks to good publicity, the San Francisco Women's Building was filled to capacity, 300-plus with standing room only. The only one missing was Alexander. 45 minutes after the scheduled starting time, he arrived, having found a parking space for his old Chrysler and wearing his familiar leather jacket. He was astonished to see the size of the crowd. After I gave him a brief introduction, he delivered what the audience had come to hear to roaring applause. The last two times I saw him were in Fort Bragg, when Cal Winslow brought him down from Petrolia to speak. I also interviewed him several times, of course, on Takes on the World, and a little more than a month ago, I left a message on Alex's answering machine, asking him back for another go-round, this time to apply his wit to the latest depressing presidential election race. That he didn't call me back was unusual, but I guessed that he was probably traveling. Only on Saturday did I realize how far. Earlier this month, I read a remarkable, albeit depressing, story on the front page of the New York Times, with the telling headlines, Earthquake Relief Where Haiti Wasn't Broken, U.S. Brokered Garment Plant Bid as Rubble Remained, end quote. It described how 2.5 years after Haiti's devastating earthquake, and thanks to the effort of the Clintons, ex-President Bill and Secretary of State Hillary, 366 Haitian farmers had been evicted from their rich agricultural land that provided food for the country's underfed population, to make way for a South Korean-owned sweatshop that is a major supplier to Walmart and Gap. But that's only part of what's being done to Haiti, as I learned when I contacted Izili Danto, Haitian-born playwright, poet, and human rights attorney in Miami, whose website is the best source on what's happening in that long-suffering and much-abused country. At about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with her about how Washington has used tax dollars, not for reconstruction of devastated country, but for the looting of Haiti's mineral wealth, the extent of which, except for the investors, seems to be a well-kept secret. Meanwhile, let's take a look at some perspectives on the news that you probably haven't heard. Let's start with Syria. As much, if not more so, than was the case with Libya, the conflict in Syria has created a bitter divide among those in the U.S. and abroad who have historically been united in opposition to U.S. foreign policy. Whereas both sides seem to agree that what is happening there is terrible. One side sees the conflict as the legitimate uprising of Syrians tired of 40 years of dictatorship, and to the exclusion of contradictory evidence, places virtually all the blame for the ongoing violence on Bashar al-Assad. The other side, viewing the conflict from a geopolitical angle, sees the drive for regime change in Syria as part of a well-documented U.S. and Israeli plan to eliminate Assad, not because of his crimes against the Syrian people, but because the fall of Assad would weaken Israel's real enemies, Iran and Hezbollah. Indeed, advocates for more aggressive U.S. policy towards Syria, all of whom by no coincidence stem either from pro-Israel think tanks or its reliable media stable, have written and said that quite openly. What's interesting is what several longtime observers in the foreign media who have no brief for dictators and who have been strong critics of Assad have begun to say. The most well-known is Robert Fisk. He's a journalist and not a political activist, and he supported the uprising against Assad from the beginning. On Sunday, however, he wrote about a young Syrian who had arrived in Lebanon from the battlefront to warn another Syrian friend in Beirut about what was happening in their home country. His story was as revealing as it was frightening, wrote Fisk. Damascus was about to be attacked, but the fighters were out of control. There were drug addicts among them. Some of our people are on drugs, a visitor said. They will take anyone out. We can't guarantee what some of these men will do. If they went to Malki, which is a mixed middle-class area of central Damascus, we couldn't protect any of the people who live there. We are against the Salafists who are fighting. There are good Syrians, Druze and Ismailis, that's Alawites, who are with us. But if we capture Damascus, we don't know how to run a small town, let alone a country. It was a true civil war story, wrote Fisk. There were bad guys among the good guys and good guys among the bad, but sectarianism is biting into the Syrian revolution. At the end of last week, one Syrian told me, adds Fisk, they are bayoneting people in the villages around Damascus. Women, they say, have been raped outside the city of Homs. One estimate puts the number of victims as high as 200, and the rapists are on both sides. That last line is what you won't hear or read on our mainstream media, although there are hints of it. After all, it is known that the new head of al-Qaeda, al-Zawahiri, put out a call months ago for jihadists to head for Syria and take up arms against Assad. They are what the young fighter from Syria meant by Salafists. One of the more troubling passages of Fisk's article occurs near the end. In recalling the beginning of the conflict, he wrote, quote, if this initially took the form of unarmed demonstrations across the country, provoked by the torture and murder of a 13-year-old boy by a secret policeman in Deraa in March of that last year, armed men did appear rapidly on the streets of some towns. There is video footage of gunmen on the streets of Deraa that same month, and Al Jazeera footage of armed men fighting Syrian troops just across the northern border of Lebanon in April 2011. Mysteriously, wrote Fisk, Al Jazeera chose not to broadcast it. Now, of course, notes Fisk, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based, make no secret of the funds and weapons they are running into Turkey and Lebanon for the resistance, without apparently caring very much who the resistors are. Yesterday's New York Times reported that the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, which took responsibility for the spate of bombings in Iraq on Monday, left over 100 people dead, Shia and Sunni, praised the Syrian insurgents, declaring, quote, you have taught the world lessons in courage, jihad, and patience, end quote. And in this morning's Times was a report of a new video circulating on the internet with, quote, the sort of image that has become a staple of the Syrian revolution, masked men calling themselves the Free Syrian Army and brandishing AK-47s with one unsettling difference. In the background, you can see two flags of al-Qaeda. Well, you've heard Grant Smith of IRMEP, Institute for Research Middle East Policy, on this program a number of times, reporting on what he's learned from declassified government files that put a very different, far harsher light on U.S.-Israel relations than the one we keep hearing from our politicians in Washington, from the president on down. His latest report, featured on the antiwar.com website, deals with partially declassified files plus seven additional pages that the FBI released this past June 27th from a 1985-2002 investigation into how a network of front companies connected to the Israeli Ministry of Defense illegally smuggled nuclear triggers out of the United States. The newly released FBI files detail how Richard Kelly Smythe, who was convicted of running a U.S. front company, met with Israeli contact Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel during the smuggling operation. Yes, that's right. The current Israeli prime minister, who gives marching orders to all but a handful of members of Congress, even is threatening to attack Iran over its presumed nuclear weapons program. At the time, according to the FBI files, Netanyahu worked as the Israeli node of the smuggling network Helai Trading Company. Netanyahu recently issued a gag order at the smuggling network's unindicted ringleader refrain from discussing Project Pinto. The story was reported on the right-wing Israel National News, Arutz 7 site, and the Hebrew-language daily Mariv, which quite openly spelled it out. Quote, according to the FBI documents released by the United States, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was involved in smuggling in the 70s from the U.S. components of Israeli nuclear program and assisted by the businessman Arnon Milshon, who, according to previous publications, was a former Mossad agent. The documents, the paper goes on, describe the findings of the investigation performed between the years 1985 and 2002 on about how a network of front companies, a U.S. security firm, illegally smuggled equipment used for weapons seeds out of the U.S., end quote, confirming what Grant Smith had written. As previously revealed in a previously released FBI files and in a biography, quote, confidential, the life of secret agent turned Hollywood tycoon Arnon Milshon, the Hollywood producer was recruited into Israel's economic espionage division, LACAM, in his 20s, the same one that ran convicted spy Jonathan Pollard, and learned how to establish front companies and secret bank accounts for smuggling operations in this country. Milshon encouraged Smythe, a California engineer, to incorporate Milco in 1972 and serve as a front for acquisitions by the Israeli-based Helai Trading Company, also known as Milshon Limited, of sensitive military technologies on behalf of Israel's Ministry of Defense. Smythe fled the U.S. after being indicted for violating the Arms Export Control Act in the mid-1980s. In July 2001, he was arrested in Spain by Interpol and returned to the U.S., and that November, he was convicted of exporting 800 nuclear triggers, called Kritons, to Israel. A secret FBI report of an interview with Smythe in April 2002 reveals how, during a trip to Israel, he was spotted, quote-unquote, by Milshon, who claimed he worked as an exclusive purchasing agent for the Ministry of Defense. Smythe was introduced around to high military officials, including then-General Ariel Sharon. He was also put in contact with Netanyahu, who worked at Helai Trading Company, and according to the FBI report, Smythe and Netanyahu would meet in restaurants in Tel Aviv and in Netanyahu's home and or business. It was not uncommon for Netanyahu to ask Smythe for unclassified material. End quote. On the book's website, authors Meir Doron and Joseph Gelman report that, quote, Milshon has been asked directly by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Shimon Peres to avoid any public discussion of the book, Confidential, asserting that the matter is too sensitive at this time. Confidential, which describes in detail Mr. Milshon's crucial covert contributions to Israel's nuclear program, has been picked up and covered by numerous enemy state-run media outlets, including Iran's Press TV and Syria's news services. The matter has also been covered in Al Hayat, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, and many other media outlets across the Middle East. They go on. With escalating tensions with Iran over its nuclear program and the recent assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists, the book Confidential has not been welcomed by Israel's security establishment, particularly as it relates to timing. The extensive media coverage, especially by enemy media, say the book's authors, has resulted in a substantial increase in Mr. Milshon's security arrangements, including extraordinary additional precautions. Grant Smith points out that, quote, although the book's authors point to the escalating tensions over Iran's nuclear program, Netanyahu's own hands-on involvement in nuclear weapons-related covert action against the United States is presumably a far more compelling reason for the gag order. Commenting on this story in last weekend's edition of Counterpunch, writer Saul Landau asked, where's the Netanyahu scandal in the New York Times? Does it matter what Israelis do? I guess we know the answer. Just like Congress, the U.S. media seems to be taking its orders from Israel. If you want to see the FBI documents for yourself, go to Grant Smith's website. That's IRMEP, I-R-M-E-P, .org/ILA. I-R-M-E-P dot O-R-G /ILA.